In the following recording by the LA Sound Posse, you will hear Lester Brown speaking to the Los Angeles World Affairs Council on February 8th of 2006. He discusses his latest work and his book, Plan B 2.0, a critical update on the rapidly deteriorating biosphere. In this report, he presents a plan, a budget, and a timetable for rescuing 21st century civilization.
And with that, to start the formal proceedings, let me ask the Chairman of the World Affairs Council and the Chairman and Chief Executive Officer of Mattel Incorporated, Mr. Bob Eckert, to take the stand to introduce our guest. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Curtis. Welcome to another beautiful, bright, sunny day in Southern California. Thank you for joining us for this meeting of the Los Angeles World Affairs Council. Today we'll discuss issues about which there are sharp differences of opinion: climate change, global warming, and environmental sustainability. Within the scientific community, there's a growing consensus that the Earth is warming. I know that myself because I was talking to my daughter who lives in Ann Arbor, Michigan yesterday, where it's been about 50 for the last month. And that's not like the Midwest where I grew up. Humanity's greenhouse gas emissions are making a significant contribution to this warming. The International Panel on Climate Change, for example, recently concluded that most of the warming over the last 50 years is attributable to human activities. This position was reiterated in June 2005 by an international group of science academics from the G8 countries, Brazil, China, and India. Others, however, challenged the concept of rapid climate change and point to the enormous economic costs of restructuring the global environment. Lester Brown has been in the vanguard of the environmental movement for over 40 years. He began his career as an international agriculture analyst in the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Foreign Agricultural Service, and later became an advisor to Agriculture Secretary Orville Freeman. In 1969, he left government service to help establish the Overseas Development Council, and in 1974, with the support of the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, he founded the World Watch Institute, the first research institute devoted to the analysis of global environmental issues. In 2001, he founded the Earth Policy Institute, whose mission is providing a vision of an environmentally sustainable economy and eco-economy, as well as a roadmap of how to get from here to there. Mr. Brown is the author of over 50 books, translated into 40 languages. He's the recipient of numerous prizes and awards, including a MacArthur Fellowship, the United Nations Environment Prize, and the Blue Planet Prize for exceptional contributions to solving global environmental problems. In his latest book, Plan B 2.0, Mr. Brown has outlined a plan, a budget, and a timetable for rescuing 21st century civilization. His plan includes eradicating poverty, stabilizing population, and conserving the Earth's biological diversity while protecting its natural resources. He calls for new priorities, new responses, and economists who can think like ecologists, as well as political leaders who understand the link between the economy and its environmental support systems. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome me in welcoming Lester Brown to Los Angeles and to our podium.
Thanks much. In his introduction, Bob was talking about some of the environmental issues and sort of where things stand. Those of us who've been working on environmental issues for some decades now have been convinced that we need to restructure the economy for the simple reason that it's slowly destroying its natural support systems. I mean, forests are shrinking, fisheries are collapsing, soils are eroding, deserts are expanding. Coral reefs are dying. You can go down the list. Water tables are falling. Temperatures are rising. Ice is melting. But not enough of us have been convinced to make the substantial changes that are needed. But what's happening in China now, I think, is going to convince just about anyone who's engaging this issue. Ever since we can remember, ever since I can remember, just about, we've been saying that the U.S., with 5% of the world's people, has been consuming a third to 40% of the Earth's resources. That was true. It is no longer true. In the consumption of most basic resources, China has now overtaken the United States. In the food sector, grain and meat, the energy sector, oil and coal, the industrial sector, steel. Of those five basic resources, China now consumes more than the United States of all except oil. We still have a solid lead with oil. But with meat consumption, China consumes almost twice as much meat as we do in the United States. Steel consumption, China consumes more than twice as much as we do, 258 million tons to 104 million tons. I mean, we're not even the same league as China in steel consumption. So things are changing. Now that China has overtaken the United States in the consumption of most basic resources, we're then given license to ask the next question, which is, what happens if China catches up to us in consumption per person? And if we assume that the Chinese economy grows at 8% per year, a bit slower than in recent years, until 2031, in that year, income per person in China will be the same as in the United States today. If we further assume that China's consumption pattern will be similar to that in the United States, that is, that they will spend their money more or less as we do, then China's grain consumption will be equal to 2/3 of the current world grain harvest. Its paper consumption at the U.S. per capita level will be double current world production. There go the world's forests. If China has three cars for every four people, as we do, it will have a fleet of 1.1 billion cars. The world fleet is currently 800 million cars. It would have to pave in roads, highways, and parking lots an area comparable to the area now planted in rice. In 2031, China's 1.45 billion people would be consuming 99 million barrels of oil a day. The world is currently producing 84 million barrels a day and may never produce much more than that. What China is teaching us is that the Western economic model, the fossil fuel-based, automobile-centered, throwaway economy, is not going to work for China. If it doesn't work for China, it will not work for India, which by 2031 will have an even larger population. Nor will it work for the other 3 billion people in the developing countries who are also dreaming the American dream. And in some ways, most importantly, in an increasingly integrated global economy where we all depend on the same oil, grain, steel, it will not work for the industrial countries either. It will not work for us. China is useful in the sense that because it's so big and because it's growing so fast, it's sort of telescoping history, helping us see where the world is headed. The challenge for our generation is to replace the old economic model, fossil fuel-based, automobile-centered, throwaway economy, with a new economy, one that's powered by renewable sources of energy, one that has a much more diversified transport system, and one that has a comprehensive reuse, recycle economy. This is the challenge for our generation. Now, one of the questions that flows from this analysis is, what will convince us that we have to not only restructure the global economy, but we have to do it quickly? I mean, we're not going to wait until 2031 to discover that the old economic model is no longer working. In fact, I don't think we're going to go too much further down this road with the old economic model. It simply cannot take us, the world, where we want to go. The challenge is to restructure the economy so that economic progress can continue, and it can. We have the technologies. We see glimpses of the new economy now emerging in many places in the world. We see it in the wind farms of Northern Europe, for example. In Europe, 40 million people now get their residential electricity from wind farms. That's projected to approach 200 million by 2020, or half of Europe's population. We see it in the solar rooftops of Japan, in the reforested mountains of South Korea. We see it in the bicycle-friendly streets of Amsterdam and in the growing fleet of hybrid cars in the United States. So we can begin to see it emerging, but it's not moving nearly fast enough. And the challenge is to pick up the pace. Now, one of the interesting questions is, what will be the wake-up call? Well, I think there are going to be a lot of wake-up calls. I think Katrina was a wake-up call, in a sense. I mean, sort of reminded us that rising surface water temperatures in the oceans, and in particularly in the Gulf of Mexico, create more powerful, destructive storms. One can sketch out many scenarios. I'd like to sketch out one that I think is among the more likely. And incidentally, I would say that the rise in the price of oil is one of the early economic manifestations of the stresses that are developing in the world economy. We have always been concerned about the effect of high oil prices on food production costs because modern agriculture is so oil intensive. And that remains a legitimate concern. But the more important effect of high oil prices is on the demand side of the food equation. Almost everything we eat can be converted into automotive fuel. And when the price of oil is at $60 a barrel, it becomes profitable to convert many agricultural commodities either into ethanol or into biodiesel. All the major commodities can be used to produce fuel: wheat, corn, soybeans, sugarcane, you name it. What this means is that the price of oil is going to become a support price for agricultural commodities, and therefore for food prices. Because if at any time the food value of a commodity is less than the fuel value, the commodity will be converted into fuel. What began as government programs in the U.S., countries in the European community, Brazil, a scattering of other countries, what began as biofuel programs driven by government incentives, 52 cent a gallon subsidy for ethanol in this country, $1 a gallon for biodiesel produced from soybeans, for example. But the market is now taking over and driving the investment. In Brazil, there are no longer any subsidies at all for ethanol production. They don't need any because the market price of ethanol is so far above the production costs. Brazil is already meeting with Brazilian delegations in Japan and China about long-term ethanol supply contracts produced from sugarcane. In this country, we now have 95 ethanol distilleries, another 30 or 35 under construction. I mean, it's just growing by leaps and bounds. $5 billion committed to new ethanol distilleries in Brazil, private capital. In Europe, we're also now seeing growth in both ethanol and biodiesel production. What this all means is that whereas until recently, there was only one group of buyers in the commodity markets. They were buying agricultural commodities for conversion into products that would end up on supermarket shelves. Now there's a second group of buyers who are buying the same commodities for fuel producers. So what we're seeing is the emergence of competition between supermarkets and service stations for the same agricultural commodities. In Europe, this has already created a shortage of high-quality vegetable oils. The Margarine Producers Association of Europe is complaining that they can't get enough vegetable oil to satisfy the demand for margarine. Bloomberg reported last week that the world price of sugar is at the highest level in 24 years, and it is projected to rise further. The risk here, I mean, another way of looking at this at the global level, is we're seeing the stage being set for competition between the 800 million of us who are affluent enough to own automobiles and the 2 billion poorest people in the world for whom getting enough food to make it from day to day is something of a challenge. And I don't think that we have yet grasped the dimensions of this new social and political issue that is fast emerging. It is occurring against a backdrop where world grain stocks are at the lowest level in 30 years. Now, ordinarily, that would lead to some fairly bullish grain prices, but grain prices are fairly quiet now. The principal reason for that is the concern with avian flu, because one of the huge growth sectors in the world livestock and poultry area is in East Asia, importantly in China, where the demand for poultry was growing very rapidly. But now with the Asian flu, a lot of farmers in those countries are simply not willing to invest in flocks that may become infected and be slaughtered and lost. So that's sort of muting things for the moment, but it probably will not last for long. If we see a dramatic rise in world grain prices, which is a distinct possibility, I'm not talking about 15 or 20 years from now, but in the next year or two, or possibly three, then we're looking at potential political instability in low-income countries that import a large share of their grain supply. That political instability, you know, in Indonesia, Nigeria, Mexico, wherever, could easily disrupt global economic progress, begin to affect the Nikkei Index and the Dow Jones 500. So while those of us in this room could cope with the doubling of world grain prices in terms of the effect on food prices, if it begins to affect stock markets and the economic outlook, then it begins to affect everyone. It affects our investments, our pension funds, and so forth. So this is a possible scenario. I happen to think it's also a likely scenario, but one could sketch out many other scenarios where this tightening situation with resources, with oil, with water, a lot of other resources is going to begin to manifest itself in a major way. Now, up until now, I've been talking about an automotive fuel economy based on liquid fuels, gasoline or ethanol or biodiesel or what have you. There is another model, and that is using, if in this country, I'll use this U.S. to illustrate, if we were to decide either for reasons of reducing oil dependency or stabilizing climate, that we're going to dramatically reduce oil dependence and gasoline use, we could do it by simply devising a program whereby over the next 10 years we would shift entirely to the gas-electric hybrid propulsion technology, cut gasoline use in half. But hybrids give us another option. If you take a Toyota Prius, for example, and add a second storage battery and a plug-in capacity, then we can do most of our short-distance driving, the daily commute, grocery shopping, on electricity alone. We would need an electric-only button on the hybrids to do this. Entirely doable. Now, if at the same time we begin investing in hundreds of wind farms across the country, we've already got 100 plus, but hundreds of them, several hundreds, feeding cheap electricity into the grid, then we're largely running our cars on wind energy. And we've got an abundance of wind energy. 1991, U.S. Department of Energy did a national wind resource inventory. They pointed out that three of our 50 states, North Dakota, Kansas, and Texas, have enough wind energy that if harnessed, it could satisfy national electricity needs. We all said, wow, because we didn't realize quite how huge the wind resource was. But in retrospect, we now know that that was a gross underestimate, because it was based on the wind turbine technologies of 1991. Advances in wind turbine design since then enable turbines to operate at lower wind speeds, to convert wind into electricity more efficiently, and because instead of being 120 feet tall, they are 300 feet tall, they are harvesting a much larger wind regime at a higher level where winds are stronger and more reliable. The neat thing about marrying wind energy and gas electric hybrids is that the batteries in the automobiles become a storage facility for wind energy. That helps deal with the fluctuations, which are one of the weaknesses of wind energy as an energy source. But we also have, remember it's a gas electric hybrid, we have a tank of gasoline to fall back on if it's needed. This is the new option that is now beginning to get some traction. And interestingly, in Washington, there's a convergence of neocons who are concerned about our oil dependence and what it means for the future of the country, and environmentalists who both support this new energy model. There was a conference held, I think, the week before last on Capitol Hill, where a number of key members of Congress were present and endorsing the idea. I mean, it's exciting to realize that we no longer have to be dependent on oil. The neat thing about wind is it's cheap. The cost, the wind electricity equivalent of a gallon of gasoline is about 60 cents. It's economic, it's abundant, and it's ours. No one can cut off the wind supply. Not a bad deal, not a bad deal. My son was driving in West Texas some time back, and he saw one of the new wind farms, some big wind farms in Texas. Texas is probably going to overtake California as the leading state with wind electric generation within another year or so. But he said it was interesting because you could see the rows of wind turbines sort of receding toward the horizon, and scattered among the rows of wind turbines were oil wells. And the wind turbines were turning, and the oil wells were pumping. And he said it was like seeing the past and the future meet. I mean, what he was looking at was the transition from fossil fuels to wind energy, to renewable sources of energy. And I said, you know, if you go back 30 years from now, the wind turbines will still be turning, but the oil pumps, the oil wells will probably not be pumping. So this is the nature of the shift that's underway. One of the most exciting, two exciting recent developments with wind power. As most of you know, for probably the better part of the last decade, many utilities in this country have offered their customers a green power option. If you wanted to get part of all of your electricity from a green source, and usually that's been from wind, you would pay an extra 10 or 15% for your electricity. But you could feel good about it because you're encouraging investment in a clean source of energy that's locally available, that is within the country. What's happened recently, and I've studied the figures in some detail for the Austin, Texas utility, is that because of rising natural gas prices, and I think they're up, if I remember rightly, they've doubled in the last 14 months, something like that. What's happened is that those who signed up for green electricity, which is usually wind-generated electricity, have now found that the cost of that, which was once above the market price, is now below the market price. And suddenly there are a lot of environmentalists out there wanting to sign up for green electricity. There's not enough to go around. It's going to take a lot of investment to catch up. On that point, one of the more interesting developments is that I think just about a year ago, February of last year, Goldman Sachs, one of the world's largest investment bankers, maybe the largest, bought a small wind farm development company called Horizon. That company now has under construction or in the planning stages 5,000 megawatts of wind-generated electricity. 5,000 megawatts, just to put it in perspective, is equal to 17 average coal-fired power plants with 300 megawatts of capacity each. It's huge, and I don't think Goldman Sachs is doing this just because they want to be good environmentalists, though that may be a factor. They're doing it because they see this is where the future is. Horizon is a wholly owned subsidiary of Goldman Sachs. In the book Plan B 2.0, there are three principal components of the plan. One is an economic restructuring of the global economy. That does not really require any fiscal allocation. The key there is to get the market to tell the truth about the real costs of goods and services. For example, a gallon of gasoline costs, let's say, $3 a gallon in this country. It's somewhat less than that now, but the real cost of a gallon of gasoline is probably closer to $11 a gallon. There's a fairly detailed study on this that's cited in the book that simply looks at all the cost of treating respiratory illnesses from breathing polluted air, the cost of the military presence in the Middle East to protect our access to the oil there, the costs of damage from acid rain, the costs of climate change, et cetera, et cetera. You put it all together, and burning fossil fuels of any kind is a fairly costly undertaking. The Center for Disease Control did a very similar thing for cigarette smoking in this country. I think it was a study published about 3 years ago, And they looked at the cost to society of smoking a pack of cigarettes. They included two costs: the cost of treating smoking-related illnesses and the cost of lost worker productivity from those illnesses. They concluded that each pack of cigarettes smoked in this country cost society $7.18. Someone had to pay that. It might be the worker, might be the employer, might be taxpayers underwriting the cost of Medicaid. But the costs are real. Someone pays them. We need to use that model to have an official sort of study of the costs of burning a gallon of gasoline, so we can see. We are all economic decision makers, as consumers, as corporate planners, as government policy makers, investment bankers. We all respond to the market, to price signals, but the market's giving us bad information. It says the cost of a pack of cigarettes is $3, when in fact it should be $10, or that the price of gasoline is $3 when it should be $11. We need to incorporate those costs, and the way to do it is to restructure the tax system. Once we figure out what the indirect cost of those commodities are, we need to reduce income taxes and offset that with taxes on environmentally destructive activities, carbon emissions, use of pesticides, discharge of toxic waste, materials going to the landfill, et cetera, et cetera. No change in tax levels, just change the composition. Reduce income taxes, increase taxes on environmentally destructive activities. Øystein Dahle, a Norwegian who took my place as chairman of the board at World Watch a few years ago, said, this is almost a decade ago, I guess, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, he said, socialism collapsed because it did not allow the market to tell the economic truth. Capitalism may collapse because it does not allow the market to tell the ecological truth. That quote's on page 228, I think, in Plan B 2.0. I mention it because it distills into two short sentences an essential economic truth. The other two principal components of Plan B, eradicating poverty and stabilizing population, that's one component. I put those in the same package because they're so closely related. Jeffrey Sachs, economist at Columbia, formerly at Harvard, has said that for the first time in history, we have the resources in the world to eradicate poverty. What an exciting thing. It means getting all the kids of elementary school age in school, providing rudimentary health care, vaccination against infectious diseases for children everywhere, school lunch programs in the poorest of the poor countries. It means making sure that women everywhere have access to reproductive health care and family planning services. You can go down the list. The budget for that comes to, worldwide, some $68 billion. And then I talk about an earth restoration budget, reforesting the earth, restoring oceanic fisheries, soil conservation. Go down the list. That's an additional $93 billion a year. And these two come together to $161 billion. Now, $161 billion of additional expenditures is a lot of money. It's one-third of the U.S. military budget for this year. If I had to choose between investing in new weapon systems to control terrorism and dealing with these basic issues in the world, like environmental restoration and eradicating poverty and so forth, I think I would go with the latter. In my opinion, the real threats to our future are climate change, population growth, spreading water shortages, not terrorism. I think terrorism on the list, and I put it in the top 10, but not near the top. And the way to deal with terrorism is to win global public opinion. We're losing it now. We're trying to solve a problem with a military solution when the military solution does not work. I think we've got to rethink things in a fundamental way. Interestingly, what mayors are doing now, 180 of them, have signed on to the Kyoto Protocol. When you think about it, this is a political revolution at the grassroots level. These are mayors of the largest cities in the country, including Los Angeles, New York, San Francisco. 180 cities have said they're going to meet the Kyoto Protocol goals. This is a response to the leadership vacuum in Washington on the climate issue. And it's from a political scientist point of view, which I'm not, but it's a fascinating development. But it's also a sign of hope because it's coming up from the grassroots. And eventually, that will drive policy at the national level. My final point is that of all the commodities in short supply, probably the scarcest of all, is time. And one of the problems is we don't know how much time we have left. Nature sets the deadlines. Nature establishes the thresholds. We don't know whether we've reached the point now where climate change has become irreversible. If it has, for example, then the ice in the Arctic Sea, which has now shrunk some 20% in summertime over the last, say, 30 years, will continue shrinking. And the meaning of that is probably much greater than most realize. If all that ice melts, that doesn't affect sea level. But what's happening is that incoming sunlight, when it hits snow and ice, 80% of it is reflected back into space. 20% is absorbed as heat. But when the incoming sunlight hits open water where the ice has melted, that ratio is roughly reversed. 20% is reflected back into space. 80% is absorbed as heat. This is why the Arctic is warming so fast. This is what modelers call a positive feedback loop. That is a trend which, once well underway, begins to feed on itself. Now, the problem with the ice melting in the Arctic Sea is not that that will raise sea level, but that it warms the Arctic region and is starting to melt the Greenland ice sheet. Greenland's three times the size of Texas. That ice sheet is a mile and a half thick in places. If that all goes, and it'll take a couple centuries probably at a minimum, but if it all goes, sea level rises 23 feet. Many of the world's coastal cities would be underwater. All of the rice-growing river deltas and floodplains of Asia would be underwater. And what it sets the stage for is, for the first time in history, to the best of my knowledge, what I would call a fracturing of society along generational lines. We've had fracturing of societies along racial and religious and ethnic, even geographic lines. But now, for the first time, we may face it along generational lines. The next generation will be asking the question, why didn't you do something? Why did you sit and watch this scenario unfold? They'll be able to read the same scientific literature that we're reading today that expresses a growing sense of urgency within the scientific community, a growing sense of urgency that has not yet been translated into a reduction in atmospheric CO2 emissions. Plan B 2.0 is seen by many as a book about the environment, and it is. I am, by training, a natural scientist and an environmentalist, but it's also about the future of the economy and thus about the future of our early 21st century civilization. Jared Diamond makes it very clear in his book Collapse that when societies get on an economic path that is environmentally sustainable, that is environmentally unsustainable, they have two choices. They can either change course or continue with what I call Plan A, business as usual, and watch the economy's environmental support systems eventually decline to the point where the economy itself declines and eventually collapses. So these are the choices I think we're facing, and with an urgency that I don't think most of us yet realize. Mr. Chairman, thank you very much.
With that, we'll open the floor.
How will we reduce our population?
The question is, how do we reduce our population? I think the challenge we're facing on the population front is more serious than is often realized. It is sort of, 20 years ago, it was very much front and center as an issue, but it's sort of faded away. But when you realize that the nearly 3 billion people to be added during this half century will be added in countries where water tables are already falling and wells are going dry, you begin to realize that this is not a promising situation. And the key, it seems to me, is first of all, educational understanding the role of population and its relationship to resource availability. I mean, consider a world in which population is growing and oil production is falling, which is one that probably most of us in this room will see. It'll be a very different world than any we've known in the past. because the oil supply per person will be shrinking both as a result of falling oil production, but also because of population growth. And that's going to make adjustments far more difficult. And the reason I put eradicating poverty and stabilizing population in the same package in the book is because I think they're closely related. The faster we can educate, particularly young females, and eradicate poverty, the faster the world will move towards smaller families and population stability. Now, incidentally, when I was talking about educating women, I was really talking about educational equality, because, as you know, in most developing countries, the number of girls who are in school in any given age group is substantially less than boys. I think we need universal primary school education across the board. Now, beyond that, the educating should involve both males and females. And interestingly, and I talk about this in Plan B 2.0, the country in the world that has, in many ways, the most sophisticated family planning program today is Iran. In Iran, a young couple wanting to get married cannot get a license unless they agree to take, I think it's a 1.5 or 2 day seminar or course in family planning, technologies, the responsibilities of parenthood, and so forth. It's an amazing sort of thing. They also have, the only Muslim country I know of where this is the case, they've legalized vasectomies for men. They've established some 70,000 clinics in rural villages throughout Iran to make sure that women everywhere and men have access to family planning services. I won't go into detail, you can read about it in the book, but the education of women is also important in its own right, because the social indicator that correlates most closely with both the shift to smaller families and to improve nutrition is the educational level of the mother. And if you think about it, it makes sense. I can tell. Thank you. Thank you for the question. I understand that very well, because it's a widespread feeling that, you know, what can I do about it? I would remind you of what Margaret Mead once said, and which most of us have heard many times, which is that all great movements begin with one person. And the most important point that I drew from doing this book, or at least one of the most important, is that saving civilization is not a spectator sport. We all have a stake in it, and we all need to get involved. That means to become politically active at the local level, at the national level. It means electing representatives in Congress who are interested in and concerned about and willing to do something on these issues, who are willing to address the issue of national priorities and the use of fiscal resources. It means writing letters to the editor of the paper. It means getting friends together and lobbying your member of Congress when he or she is back in the area, letting them know of your concerns. I mean, I mentioned what's happening at the city level in this country as being an interesting manifestation of a growing sense of concern about the lack of progress in Washington on the climate issue. We need much more of that, and we need all of us to be involved. And we each have to figure out our own sort of plan for what we can do and how we can do it, and maybe even a timetable for doing it. Excuse me, if I understood the question, it's about the visual effect of wind farms? I think a lot depends on what one sees when one sees a wind farm. To some, it's a blight on the landscape. When I see a wind farm, I see a design that's aesthetically, to me, quite pleasing. I mean, they're rather elegant in their nature. I also see a source of energy that will last as long as the sun lasts. You know, these wells will not go dry, and they will not disrupt the Earth's climate system. So I see something very positive. I mean, how we react to wind depends a lot on what we see. Let me use another example. My parents' generation sort of came of age during the Depression. If they'd been reacting to images on the screen and you'd put a bulldozer on the screen, they would have responded very positively to that because it suggested there was some construction someplace and maybe some jobs and so forth. Most of us today, if we're reacting to images, we react very negatively to a bulldozer. And the same is true with wind turbines. It depends a lot on what you see. Now, interestingly, in some communities, as your question implies, there's opposition to wind farms. And there are problems if they're too close to, you know, densely populated areas. But in some parts of the country, there's not the NIMBY problem, not in my backyard, but the PIMBY problem. Put it in my backyard. I married into a ranching family on the Wyoming-Colorado border some 45 years ago, so I have in-laws and relatives in that area. And the interesting thing is that when the Colorado utility, for example, announces it's going to develop another 200 megawatts of wind-generating capacity, the competition among communities in that area on both sides of the state border for the new wind farms is intense because the ranchers will get the royalties. You know, a turbine generates $100,000 worth of electricity. If they get a 5% royalty, they get $5,000 a year for each turbine on their ranch. They don't have to invest a penny. They can keep grazing the land. And there'll be jobs. There'll be tax revenue to help improve the local school system. And most of the money spent on wind-generated electricity stays in the community. It doesn't go somewhere else in the country or the world. So these are real attractions to people in many parts of the country.
Take the lady's hand there, and then we'll get over there.
Right. Probably the most important advance in wind farm siting has been taking that issue into account and deciding where to put the wind farm. In the early days, Altamont Pass, for example, no one even thought about that. But now, I don't think any wind farms are being built without a study of that ahead of time to guide the siting process. The other interesting thing here is that if there have been fairly detailed studies on bird deaths in the United States, the two principal causes of death of birds are cats and cars. And I've forgotten the exact number, but one is like 21 million birds a year and the other is 24 million birds a year. Wind power is so small you can't even see it on the chart by comparison, nor will it ever be very large compared with cars and cats. But we haven't really restricted the number of cars or the number of cats in order to protect birds.
Right.
Well, there are many reasons. I mean, many things to think about when we think about nuclear energy. I think a lot of this is coming from the industry itself and the lobby they have in Washington. I don't think you have to get by costs to realize it's not a viable option. I mean, when you look at nuclear energy, we have to deal with the cost of waste disposal. We have to deal with the cost of decommissioning nuclear power plants. Very costly, maybe as costly as building them in the first place or even more so. The cost of insurance. I mean, you have to find insurance companies that would insure nuclear power plants, which we haven't been able to find in this country, certainly. So there are a lot of costs. And in an age of terrorism, I don't think there's any major source of energy that would be more vulnerable than nuclear power plants. So that's another, the security cost of trying to protect them all the time and guard them 24 hours a day. So when you look at the cost of nuclear power, if you put them all on the table, you don't get beyond square one. You can also look at the spread of weapons, for example. I think every country that has nuclear weapons use nuclear power as a stepping stone to get there. Right? Now, if we're going to go the nuclear route, do we say that all countries can have nuclear power? Or do we say that only some countries can have nuclear power? And if you have an A list and a B list, who makes the list? And then who enforces it? I don't know anyone who has an answer to those questions. So that's also one of my concerns about nuclear power. Yeah, we do hear the talking, but we don't see any investing. Nowhere in the world, nowhere is anyone investing in a nuclear power plant in a competitive energy market. Where they have to pay all the costs.
Before Mr. Eckert comes back to close the meeting, we're going to have time for one last question, sir.
Yeah, good question. In the original Plan B that was written 3 years or so ago, I talked about the hydrogen fuel cell model for the automotive fuel economy. I did not talk about it in this book because it takes time to create the infrastructure. And I'm beginning to think we don't have, you know, the 15, 20, or 25 years required to do that. And also, fuel cells are not moving very fast in terms of getting the costs within reach of consumers. So the principle, one of the major concerns here is time. And the nice thing about gas electric hybrids and wind energy is these technologies are already on the market, already expanding very rapidly. It's just a matter of tying them together with the plug-in capacity. And we use the same infrastructure, the same electrical grid, the same network of gasoline stations. We may have to strengthen the grid somewhat in parts of the country so it can carry a sufficient load, but it's entirely possible. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. And now we're adjourned. Have a great afternoon.
You have been listening to Lester Brown speaking to the Los Angeles World Affairs Council on February 8th of 2006. He discussed his latest work and his book, Plan B 2.0, a critical update on the rapidly deteriorating biosphere. In this report, he presents a plan, a budget, and a timetable for rescuing 21st century civilization. This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We use the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-alike 2.5 license to ensure the ongoing public availability of these recordings. We share them via the internet, community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD. You can download it for free at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. If you value what you heard in this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, and thus becoming yourself a part of a decentralized, democratic, civic media.